Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Almost half the households in this country include at least one cat or dog, not to mention millions more that are home to other pets. Yours may be one of them. We love our pets when they're good, but that's not always the case. So what can we do when their behavior is a problem? Well, we can call in our guest, Dr. Deborah Horwitz. She's a veterinarian and veterinary behaviorist who owns and operates Veterinary Behavior Consultation, specializing in companion animals. If you have a companion pet problem, give us a call. Dr. Horwitz will answer your questions and mine. Debbie, nice to have you back with us again.
It's great to be here.
I'm anticipating a number of calls. There are so many cats and dogs out there.
Oh, I'm ready.
Oh, you're good. Well,
I already had a nice conversation with your receptionist. We talked about different dog breeds and what makes a breed, and it was very interesting.
So you're all warmed up for this conversation.
Yeah.
I'm going to give our phone numbers right off the bat. 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email if you'd like to talk@stlpublicradio.org, or if you'd prefer to send a tweet, do so at STL on Air. A couple of background questions, Debbie, as we get started here. What are the major behavioral issues that you deal with on an ongoing basis?
Well, there are really two types of problems that we deal with. The first are normal behaviors that are unwanted. And the second is abnormal behaviors. Mm-hmm. So many of the problems that people have with their pets are actually normal behaviors that are unwanted. So dogs dig, but if they dig up your garden or your yard, you're unhappy with that. Cats scratch furniture. They scratch things in their environment to mark. If they do it indoors, you're unhappy with that. Mm-hmm. Even aggression is not abnormal. Oh, excuse me.
Maybe we can get some water in the studio for
I do have water right here.
Oh, you do.
I should have talked all the way down here in the car. Sometimes I do that to warm myself up. Aggression isn't abnormal when the animal's trying to tell you, leave me alone or I'm in pain, something like that. But the things that most commonly they come and seek help about our aggression or towards themselves or other people for dogs or cats and destruction, either when they're home or when they're gone.
Is there any way we can read them to determine whether or not the issue is pain or illness as opposed to just a mean-spirited critter?
Well, that's a really good question. I don't believe that animals are ever spiteful because spiteful behavior is, if you look at the definition of it, spiteful behavior is behavior that doesn't benefit the person doing it or the person that receives it. Now, I use the word person. You could say animal as well. So spiteful behavior has no benefit to anyone. And animals in general aren't usually spiteful because they really spend a lot of time thinking about the cost or the benefit to them. But they're often anxious and frustrated and uncertain about what to do. So more often than not, that's what is their underlying motivation for what they're doing, or they're under exercised, or they don't have enough enrichment in their environment. Dogs really like to do dog stuff, and cats really like to do cat stuff, and those are things that we don't necessarily find attractive, so we don't provide them.
Do they pick up on problems in the household, if there's tension in a household, and does that cause them to act out?
I always have told my clients, I'm really sorry about this, and that nobody likes change unless it's their idea. And so often there's tension in the household because change is taking place. Either you have new job hours or you're going to move or you just had a baby or you're having an argument with your partner or something like that. And those things create change. They create change in the level of tension in the household. They might create change in when a dog goes for a walk or when the litter box gets cleaned. So, yes, when things are different than they expect, they respond to that. They're sentient beings, and especially dogs, they've co-evolved with us to really read our emotions.
They are pretty good at that, aren't they? I mean,
they
it
are.
It seems to me, in any case.
They are, and cats are too. Cats are not quite as – they didn't involve as closely with us because what we needed them to do, we didn't need to help them, which was kill vermin and keep our grain safe. But dogs, we wanted them to hurt our cattle and our sheep and protect our dwellings and help us hunt. So in order for them to be useful to us, we had to pick dogs that were very responsive to either looking at us or hand signals or verbal commands.
What about discipline? How should we discipline either a dog or a cat that has a problem?
Well, if you think of dog or cats really emotionally and intellectually like toddlers, so 2 to 3 year olds, we know in that age that we yelling at them or physical reprimands are not effective ways of changing behavior, because punishment just tells you what not to do. Mm-hmm. It doesn't tell you what to do. And when you don't have a common language, which you don't necessarily with a two-year-old, and you definitely don't with a dog or a cat, then it's much easier to teach them what you want than to punish what you don't. And realize that mistakes that are made are often mistakes of omission on our part of either setting up the environment for them to be successful rather than commission on their part.
So to get one or the other to do what you want, you have to have a pocket full of treats, I assume, and
sometimes,
that sort of thing. Yeah.
Sometimes, for example, people don't like when cats scratch the furniture. Hmm. All right. So for many years, and especially in the United States, it's very popular to declaw your cat. And there's been a move against that. In many European countries, it's outlawed. And here in the United States, the American Veterinary Medical Association deems it an unnecessary procedure in most cases. And some people say, well, I tried a scratching post and it didn't work. Well, if you understand why cats scratch, then you can provide them with a scratching post and they will use it. They primarily scratch when they first get up. So they're stretching like we stretch. So it should be near where they sleep. And they want to leave a message so it's in the most prominent location in the room, which is usually the arm of your sofa. So you need to put it somewhere where, from the cat's perspective, it's a valuable place to go to leave your message. And that doesn't mean in the corner of the basement, then they're not going to use it.
What about tone and with both cats and dogs? I mean, they have to be sensitive to that.
Oh, yes. They're very sensitive to our tone of voice. I often use this example in lectures. I had a Labrador Retriever. She lived to be 16. And like most Labrador Retrievers, she loved to eat. It was her favorite thing to do. And so if you said to her, is it time to feed the dog? She'd start barking and jumping up and down. But you could say, is it time to weed the hog? And she would do the same thing because it sounds very much alike. Uh-huh. So tone of voice has a big impact when you're trying to teach your dog a new cue and a new task like sit. It's much better if you say sit rather than sit, because even though there's this whole theory that you have to dominate your dog and control them, in reality, they already know how to sit. Hmm. We're just trying to put it under verbal control.
So if you say to a dog, stop, like that, are they going to basically understand what you're saying?
I think if you use a strong voice and you use a verbal reprimand, you will interrupt the behavior. But interrupting a behavior is not the same thing as not having it happen again. And that's a trap that a lot of people fall into, because they'll say, well, when he barks, I yell at him and then he stops. So he knows he shouldn't bark. But he doesn't, you know, he's spiteful. He doesn't listen to me because when the doorbell rings, he barks again. And what you've done is interrupted the ongoing behavior. So I shouldn't keep barking, but what you want to stop is I shouldn't start barking. And those are different things.
When you've interrupted the behavior, give them the treat to say that that was good that you stopped?
And you also have to reward the absence of noise. So if the dog's barking and you have a treat in hand and you say, stop it, and the dog looks at you, then you would say, good, stop it, and give him a treat. And stop it would be your command that the dog knows if I'm silent, I get a reward.
We're coming up on a break, and we have a caller who wants to get into the discussion. So let's take him before the break. That would be Andy in St. Louis. Andy, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I have a question. My little 5-year-old boy has a little puppy, and the puppy sort of bites back, like with a sort of menacing sort of bite, it seems like. And like, for instance, the other night he bit Parker on the cheek. Just all he did was pick him up and he reared around and bit him. And he'll also, certain people, he'll kind of like attack them a little bit and not let up.
Well, it's hard to, first of all, obviously your 5-year-old and the puppy need some more supervision, so that when it looks like the puppy is really agitated about something or the puppy wants to be left alone, that's respected. It's hard to categorize the behavior you're talking about without actually seeing the dog. So there are times when puppies are play biting because that's what they do with other puppies and other dogs. And that behavior may be too rough and injure our skin. And if you push them away, that seems like play, so they come back. And the growling at that time sounds different, and the whole body looks different. It looks playful. Some animals, when they're resting, don't want to be bothered. And puppies and dogs are the same way, and they don't always want to be picked up either. So I don't know the whole circumstance, and of course, in this question-answer format, it's hard to go into it. But in general, when a dog or a cat or a puppy or a kitten are resting, it's better to approach them and talk to them and see if they stand up and indicate they want to be picked up. Because maybe the puppy was resting and didn't want to be picked up, and when it struggled, instead of putting it down, we often keep picking them up, and unfortunately, the puppy was probably scared and wanted to be left alone and did something that is the wrong behavior. Biting is incorrect behavior. And I would suggest you talk to your veterinarian about a good puppy class that can help you and your 5-year-old boy and your puppy learn how to communicate with each other so that you don't get in situations where the puppy feels threatened and has the need to bite. Otherwise, it's not going to be a pleasant experience for anyone.
I have to take a break in just a couple of seconds here. But very quickly, are puppies, I'll limit it to dogs in this case, are they capable of jealousy? I ask that with regard to a new baby in the household, for instance. If the dog has been there for a while, can it become jealous of the baby?
There's been some interesting studies about jealousy, and there are some people who feel that dogs, for example, studies have shown that dogs can tell the difference when, and so can chimps, by the way, when another dog gets a more valuable or better treat than they do. Yeah. So they're aware of that disparity. But in the situation that you're talking about, if you've ever had a new baby in your house, you know that your life changes. And the time you're able to spend with the dog and respond to that dog's needs are going to change. So sometimes you see some attention-seeking behaviors that are an attempt to get what they want.
Let's hold that thought. If there's more to say, I have to take that break now. Dr. Deborah Horwitz is our guest, veterinarian and a behaviorist, if you will. We're talking animal behavior. Back in just a few moments or so, this is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back as we continue our conversation with Dr. Deborah Horwitz, veterinarian and veterinary behaviorist. She owns, by the way, and operates Veterinary Behavior Consultations. But we're talking animal behavior, obviously. Debbie, I had to take that break when we were talking about jealousy in animals. Had you finished your thought with regard to that?
I think overall when we're talking about especially something like a new baby or somebody gets married and has a combined household, there's a change in the relationship between the pet and the pet owner because there's less time for the pet. And depending on how flexible they are, how like, okay, well, this is how it is now, I can get attention from the other person that's here, then, yeah, there's some attention-seeking behaviors that may or may not be jealousy, but mostly trying to retain that level of involvement that they had before.
So what do you do as the pet owner?
One of the things that we really talk about as for pet owners is that if you're bringing home a new baby, you have time to prepare, hopefully. And it's a good idea before the baby arrives that you spend some time brushing up on basic learned skills. And one really great learned skills is teaching your pet to go to their bed or go to their mat or go to their basket and be separated a little bit from you and remain quiet for a period of time. And that way, when you are holding your baby or doing something with your baby, they're already used to having this separation time. You've rewarded it, you've trained it, and that's really good for lots of reasons, because then later we also train the crawling baby and the toddler that when the dog is in their bed or their basket, they're not to be bothered. That's mm-hmm. their space. So that would be one of the things I'd yeah. really urge people to do, is to give the dog a space and some independence.
Right. I want to go back to the phones. 382-8255 is our number, 382-TALK. Email talk at stlpublicradio.org. The tweet address is STL on air. But let's go back to Fred, who's calling from Glendale. And Fred, thanks for being so patient. You're on the air.
Hi, Don.
Hi.
Yeah, I live in a neighborhood here in Glendale that is absolutely jam-packed with dogs.
I bet.
And every time it seems that some of the owners, they put the dog out in the backyard during nice weather, of course, and the dogs immediately start barking incessantly. And I'm wondering why this is. Does it go with some breeds? But all the different breeds bark. And a friend of mine once mentioned, well, the dogs are having a separation anxiety. Does that make any sense?
Well, not all dogs who bark when they're outside are distressed about being away from the people they're attached to. So if somebody goes to work and leaves their dog outside and that dog barks incessantly, tries to get back in the house, or they have to leave that dog outside because if they leave it in the house, it's very destructive or eliminates, that dog might have separation anxiety and they should contact their veterinarian, and that can be diagnosed and treated. But dogs sometimes bark at things that dogs often bark at things that are unfamiliar. So if this is in the neighborhood, and Glendale is that kind of neighborhood where there's people walking around all day and there's bikes going by and cars going by, and if one dog barks, another dog might bark. It's fine for dogs to be outside. I think that a dog shouldn't be left outside all day in all sorts of weather. They need to be sheltered when it's too hot or when it's too cold. And if they are barking, really, if the owner's not home, they don't know. And so a polite letter or notice or stopping at the house saying, you know, I hear your dog barking. And dogs that have separation anxiety are very distressed. So they're yiping and they're howling. And I know I would want to know if my dog was distressed while I'm gone. So they might want to know that. And if they say, I don't want my dog in my house when I'm gone because he house soils or his destruction, well, the problem for them is not really barking, although the problem's for you. So they bark. It's a communication. That's how they, talk to each other.
You may have answered a question that we're going to get from Heather here, calling from St. Louis. She wants to talk about separation anxiety. Maybe she's taking a different angle on it. Go ahead, Heather. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thanks. So we got a puppy this summer, and we were all home. My husband and I both teach, and we thought this would be a great thing, that we would bond with the dog. And we realized a bit too late that we had taught the dog the expectation that we would all always be home. And so when it was time to go back to work, we realized sort of for the first time, put the dog in the crate and said goodbye. And the dog really freaked out. so we have been,
What did the dog do when you say really freaked out?
Well, so he started barking, and I thought, okay, well, I'll go in the next room away so he can't
see
me.
Has he been trained to a crate before, or this was just something?
Yes.
Okay.
No, he slept in his crate. He's happy in his crate, so it wasn't about the crate. But it was that I locked the door, and I left the room. So I was out of his sight. He really hadn't been out of our sight hardly, for 2 or 3 weeks. So I thought, well, I'll just see. So I timed it, And at 10 minutes, it was still escalating. And he was obviously trying to get out of the crate. I mean, I wasn't watching, but I could hear that he was clearly desperate to get out of the crate and scratching at it. And I mean, it sounded like he had a hammer in there. I don't know what was happening.
So let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
He'd been in his crate before. He sleeps in his crate overnight.
Yeah. Yep.
Why did you lock the door this time when you put him in the crate?
Because he's not fully potty trained.
But he was in his crate. So when you put him, there's something I'm missing here.
Yeah.
When you put him in his crate at night and go to bed.
Yeah.
Do you lock the door?
Yeah. And he's fine.
Is he out loose in the room or he's in the crate in a room with a locked door?
He's in a crate. But he's in a, and the crate is locked, but he's in a room with one of us.
So when you sleep.
It's the crate that's locked then, not the door to the room. Is that it?
The crate is locked.
Oh,
yes,
so he sleeps in the room with you. He sleeps in the room with you. Okay, I misunderstood.
Yeah,
okay.
Sorry. So this was sort of the first, this was me prepping. Well, I'm going back. I'm going to be going back to work. I'm going to have to go to campus. So let's see how he does. Let's practice for when that happens.
Well, you weren't, there are a couple of things. Number one, you weren't really gone. So he didn't know that.
Right.
So we don't know what he would do when you're actually gone from the house. I don't know if it would be necessary to close the bedroom door or not. But it might be nice if you had the time available to get him used to short departures in his crate by putting him in his crate with a signal that's new that says something different's happening. So that would be maybe putting him in his crate with a toy that's been stuffed with some peanut butter and using a key phrase like, I'll be right back. You put him in his crate. You give him the Kong with the peanut butter. You leave the room. You're in the house somewhere, and you only leave for 5 minutes.
Right.
And then you come back, and you take away the Kong, and you tell him you're free, you know, and you slowly do this at night when you're home alone and whatever. But the best thing you can do is contact your veterinarian for detailed instructions.
Heather, we have to leave it at that because we have to move on. But I hope that helps with your problem. Thank you so much with calling. Most of the calls that we get deal with dogs, and there are a lot of cats out there.
Yeah.
Is it just that cats are just – they're so aloof, if you don't mind my saying so, that they just do their own thing?
I don't know. Maybe people – cat people are at work during the day and they can't call. I don't know. I'm just kidding. We do get a lot of dog questions when you do call-in shows. Some of it has to do with the intensity of the behaviors people call about, like separation anxiety. I think this caller is right to be concerned and that the dog is upset. And he can be – so we're having – if it sounded like the dog was had a hammer, he's probably rocking the crate back and forth. He could damage himself. He could damage the house. And cats are show their behavior issues in a more subtle, less obvious way. And sometimes it takes a while for owners to recognize them unless they're – crying all the time or they're just totally not using their litter box.
Are cats easier to train than dogs? I'm guessing no.
Well, that would be like the principles of learning apply across species, but what motivates us is different. So, and the way that you make associations might be different. In some ways, cats can be easier to train for certain tasks because they're not distracted by certain things, but they're more skittish because they're also prey animals, so they get chased and eaten. So I wouldn't say one is smarter than the other, but we have less need often to train cats to do things because they don't do as many annoying things.
Well, the cats that I've had from time to time would bring home a little present. A dead mouse or a dead bird or something. They are predatory animals. Any way to correct that?
Well, one way to stop it is to keep them inside.
Yeah.
And there are risks to that because it's not an enriched environment. But outdoor life is really risky. They can get fleas and other parasites. They can get hit by a car. There are some things there's one of the most effective. It's called a cat bib, and it's kind of like a little bib that the cat wears, and it doesn't enable them to stalk and jump in the same way. I recently read about testing a collar that emits some noises that distract the birds, but I would assume with the sense of hearing a cat has, it would bother them quite a bit.
We used to put little bells on their collars.
You got to put big bells. If you really want, what you really need to do is get a jingle bell and put that on the cat's collar, and then they can't keep that one quiet. But a little bell, a good hunting cat can keep that quiet.
Let's take another quick call before our next break. Jonathan in St. Louis, it'll have to be fast. Jonathan, go ahead.
Hi there. Good afternoon.
Hi.
I had a question about my cats. At night when, about to go to bed, doesn't matter if the door's open or shut, they just become like wild kitties, and they just meow and scratch and go crazy. So is there any help to this, I guess?
Well, first of all, it helps to understand the normal ethology of a cat, which is they're diurnal. They're most active in the early morning and the early evening. So I would vary when you feed them. It might help sometimes to feed them right before you go to bed, and so split their meal up so they get a little bit of food before bed. But before you feed them, I'd have a play session, an aerobic play session with them, using toys that flutter and move and something for them to do, because that is their active time of night. The other thing you can do is there are new toys on the market that are feeder toys for cats, and you hide those around the house, and they're reusable. They sort of rip them open, and they can get out the cat food. And that might keep your cats busy if you took part of their daily food ration. And in the early evening and towards bedtime, you spread it around, and they had to hunt and play with it and feed themselves. And then they might be ready to go to sleep.
It was a few seconds before the next break. I'll ask this about dogs later, but is there a particular breed of cat that you recommend as being better for a household?
Not really. It depends what you like. And cats, there are breeds of cats that are more outgoing than some, and there are breeds of cats that there's really one or two breeds of cats that don't really shed. But otherwise, to know the personality of your cat, the best way to do that is to meet their father.
Which is sometimes hard to do with the cats.
Right.
All right. We'll leave it at that for the moment. Take our next break. Dr. Deborah Horwitz is our guest veterinarian and animal behaviorist. We'll be back in just a bit. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back to continue our conversation on pet behavior with veterinarian Dr. Deborah Horwitz. Debbie, how about the favorite breed of dog? We brought the cats into it a moment ago.
My favorite breed or the favorite breed across the country? The number one AKC breed is still the Labrador Retriever, and followed closely by the Golden Retriever. I really think that when you're going to acquire a dog, you have to think about your lifestyle and how you can provide for the sentient being to meet their needs that's going to live a long time. So I've been very fortunate. The three dogs I've had over my lifetime, two were large and one was small. One lived to be 14 and the other two both lived to be 16. But, they have a lot of care that's involved in their health care. And more importantly, you have to decide what you want from your lifestyle for your dog. If you like to go out hiking and do a lot of things, then you want a hardy dog. If you're someone who likes to stay home all the time, then you don't want a dog that needs to be active. You don't want a working breed of dog. You don't want a herding breed of dog, because they like to be busy. And whether you're busy or not, they'll be busy. So it helps to think about what you want out of the dog that you have. And, of course, you can always go to a shelter and obtain a dog. And when you do that, they'll know some idea. But think about size. Big dogs, not all big dogs are more active, but they take up more room and their medicine costs more. And so
sure.
Give it some thought.
Research. Do a little research. Is probably
do
a
little
thinking.
Research, but also examine your life and realize the commitment you're making and the financial commitment that you're making and whether or not you're going to be able to do that.
Back to the phones. Let's bring in Carol calling from St. Louis. Carol, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I had some questions about cats who urinate to communicate. A friend of mine, and he couldn't call, so I don't know that I can answer all the questions for you, but he has two cats. The one cat started a couple years after he got him urinating and pooping everywhere. He's tried different litter boxes. He's ruled out medical problems. He's tried multiple litter boxes, being with the cat and rewarding him when he uses the litter box correctly. We just can't figure out what's going on. Can you talk about that a little?
Sure. Most often when there are long-term litter box issues, and there's more than one cat in this house, correct?
Yes.
Okay. It has something to do with the toileting area that's provided for the cat. Overall, if there's no medical issues that are there, so there are no orthopedic issues that make it difficult for the cat to access the box that's provided for them. But there are a lot of things that go into providing the best toileting area for your cat. The first thing, of course, is the size of the box. So cats that are really large need a larger box than cats that might be smaller. The second thing is where the box is located. If you have, the general rule of thumb is that if you have two cats, you should have the number of boxes per cat plus one. So a cat household with two cats should have three litter boxes, but they must be in different locations. If you have three litter boxes all in the same place, you really only have one toileting area. And when you have more than one cat in your household, they may not really like each other as much as you think and are reluctant to go through certain areas or can't really access the litter box location as freely as they would like. And that's often a big part of it. And the third thing is what is in the litter box. Some cats eventually get to the point where they don't like the litter material that's provided for them or it isn't clean enough for them. The analogy that I often use when I lecture is that I ask my audience, if you go into a restroom and you go into a stall that hasn't flushed the toilet, what do you do? Do you leave? And almost everyone raises their hands that they go somewhere else. They may even flush the toilet, but they go somewhere else. And I encourage them to encourage their clients to think about a cat's toilet like that. If your cat returns to their toileting area and it's dirty, they may choose something someplace else. And if that someplace else is always clean, it may become more desirable. So basically, I would say that in this two-cat household, if there's just two cats, you need at least three litter boxes in at least two locations. If it's a multiple-story household, you need a box on every floor. The litter boxes need to be scooped at least several times a week, emptied, washed, and refilled every 7 to 14 days, depending on how often they're used. And then you need to figure out if the cats really do like each other, because cats who like each other will sleep together, they'll groom each other, and they want to be where the other cat is. If these two cats rarely, if ever, do that, then while they tolerate each other, they're not good buddies, and there might be some conflict that one cat keeps the other cat from actually getting to the litter box, but you can't guard three litter boxes.
Speaking of two cats, we have an email for Sarah who writes that one of their cats has gotten overweight because it eats all the food that's put out for the two cats. How can we manage the weight of one cat and leave the food for the other without separating the cats?
That's another interesting question about cats, because sometimes the cat that eats all the food doesn't only may have access to the food bowl at select times, so it eats as much as it can because the other cat is actually keeping that cat away from the food bowl at other times. A cat can't monopolize multiple food bowls. So if there are multiple food bowls around the house, then one cat can't possibly cover them all at the same time. Secondly, cats that are heavier are often not good jumpers. And so you can find a place to put a food bowl that's higher for the cat that's really very agile, and that cat can get up there and eat. And the cat that's heavy, once it's eaten its daily ration, it can't get you any more food.
All right. Now, there's a very practical suggestion right there. Another caller. This one is Jay calling from Normandy. Go ahead, Jay. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, folks. We have an Australian Shepherd. He's now 10. He's always been dog aggressive, and you can't really take him out in public at all. Possibly too late to retrain him because he's been this way. He's been to obedience, but he's still very dog aggressive and, frankly, wants to pull us down the street on a leash and all that kind of stuff. We have a haltie for that to try to prevent that. But is that something we would see when we get another Aussie, or would you maybe avoid an Aussie? By the way, we have two collies, and he rules the roost. But is that typical of an Aussie breed, Australian Shepherd?
Well, dog aggression is hard to categorize unless you can talk in more detail about it. But there are a couple of things that happen. Sometimes there are young dogs that are very exuberant when they react to other dogs. And so they bark and they pull towards them. And when we're trying to calm them down, if we pull on the leash and we yell at them and we tell them no, over time, one of the things that happens is the approach of other dogs actually becomes a predictor of bad things happening to them. When initially they were just exuberant to get there, they now are trying to keep the dogs away so they won't be yelled at. So that's a possibility. Another possibility is that they, during their period of socialization, they didn't spend enough time with enough dogs to learn how to appropriately interact. The third possibility is that sometime when they encountered other dogs, they had a bad experience, and now they feel like the best defense is a good offense. Be that as it may, the best thing you can do for the dog you have is, if you're going to walk your dog, then you should try to walk him in low traffic times when there aren't a lot of other people out walking their dogs, so that he doesn't get reinforced for his behavior, because as he barks and lunges, the dogs stay away, which at this point is exactly what he wants. He doesn't want them to get close. So you might try taking him to places to walk him where you're not going to encounter other dogs. I wouldn't take him to a park where there are a lot of other people walking dogs, etc. As for ruling the roost of your collies, they probably don't care about the same things. And I'm not sure what you mean by ruling the roost, but if he wants something and he gets it and they don't want it, then they're going to let him have it. And that's pretty normal dog behavior. As for the breed in general, they're very energetic working breeds of dogs. And they generally need a job. And with that quick ability to learn and respond does sometimes come more reactivity. If you were going to get another Aussie, I would re-examine how you introduce this dog to the world he was going to live in and maybe do some things differently and work with. There are a lot of groups that do a lot of training with Aussies who are very tuned in to their abilities and what they need. So good luck.
Time is winding down. It's been a very fast hour. A couple of quickies here, Debbie. Question in front of me, are there any St. Louis factors that influence pets' behavior here, like heat, humidity, cold, whatever?
One of the biggest influences on pets here, I mean, heat and humidity, you know, if you have a long-haired, if you have a northern breed of dog, it's harder for them to be outside. But in general, I think one of the big things that is an influence is our thunderstorms, because there are a certain percentage of dogs who are noise sensitive. And we have a lot of thunderstorms. And not only do we have a lot of thunderstorms, but we can have them day after day after day. So whereas a dog might be upset by one thunderstorm, when they're five or six in a week, they never get an opportunity to relax. So I would say that if you have a dog that shows some sensitivity during a thunderstorm, when they're exposed the first two, three, four times, I would talk to your veterinarian or a good positive trainer about ways to encourage your dog to be more comfortable in a thunderstorm. So that is something that, yes, in practice we see a lot of storm phobic dogs here.
Boy, we have so many questions and so little time. I wish we had more, Debbie Horowitz.
I'll come back.
Yeah, well, I hope you do. I hope you do. This is fascinating stuff, and a lot of people have questions.
Thank you so much,
Debbie Horowitz, for being with us, veterinarian and
behaviorist. Thank you for having me.
That is it for us for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.